First of all, can you hear me at the back?
No.
What do you mean, no? Well, you're one of the lucky ones. What a lovely introduction. Thank you very much. I'm not sure I can actually live up to it, and I'm overwhelmed to see so many people here, but it is quite warm in here, isn't it? And they tell me you haven't paid to get in, so perhaps that accounts for it. I thought, I haven't really prepared anything because I just got off an aeroplane recently, so my body still thinks it's 4 a.m, so if I do fall asleep halfway through, I'll be one step in front of you lot. I thought what I'd do is just warble on for a bit, and then when I see your eyes glaze over, I will invite questions, and those still awake can then ask me about what you're actually interested in, as opposed to the things that I will assume, probably wrongly, that you're interested in. And I thought I'd... Isn't it this kiss of death when someone takes their watch off, by the way? Because you know it's going to be long, but I don't have many notes. I thought I'd divide my remarks more or less into three. First of all, the impressions of a very young, very innocent foreign correspondent on his first assignment going into what the media in those days called Red China. and then I thought I'd speak a little bit about the amazing people, the Western residents, and indeed the non-Western residents of Peking, a very small group, and we lived a rather isolated life, cut off by the Chinese as much as they could from the people around us. And then finally, I thought I'd just say a few words about what was a momentous year and a great year to be a journalist in China, sort of annus mirabilis, which was 1976, where events seemed to tumble one on top of the other, and I suppose were I a historian, which I'm not, I would say it was one of the key pivotal years in modern Chinese history. Before I do that, I've been told that I should say a few words about my time at Leeds, since this is indeed the 50th anniversary of East Asian Studies, or Chinese Studies, as it was when I was here, and a few words, and it will only be a few words, about what brought me to Leeds. I didn't follow the normal going to school, going to university route. I left the sort of Atacama, the intellectual Atacama desert of a secondary modern school when I was 15. I got out under the wire just before they raised the school leaving age to 16, and I had one overriding ambition in those days, and that was to buy the largest and most powerful motorcycle I possibly could. So I spent a year doing some very boring jobs, earning some money, getting my motorbike license, and then drove off for more or less the next 2 years around Europe. And I was lucky enough to get jobs in various places, and I ended up in Athens. I learned a bit of French on the way, improved my French, learned a bit of modern Greek, gave English conversation lessons when I was in Athens to some lesser members of King Constantine's family. He'd gone into exile, but some of them were still living there. Athens was an interesting place. It was the days of the colonels, the Greek junta. So there were riots on a daily basis, and Athens at night was redolent with the smell of tear gas. So not much changed, really. It's just like that now. To cut a long story short, I came back, motorbike still running, and I decided I'd like to go to university, primarily because I discovered girls. Motorbike first, girls came later, and the girls who attracted me most were the cleverest girls, so I thought I'd better go to university. And I went to a college of further education. These are institutions which were quite new in the 60s. These days they tend to be called sixth form colleges. I'm very keen on them. I teach in one at the moment. And I did day classes. And what are you looking for, dear? Have you
Sorry,
lost something?
I was trying to turn the thing off behind you.
Oh, I don't mind. It's rather nice. I didn't notice it. Pretty flowers. I don't have any, there's no audio visual with this talk, by the way. I don't have... what is it, that thing on Microsoft does where, I don't have any of that stuff. It's just me. Where did I get to? Oh, yes, okay. So I came back, I did day classes and night classes for a year, took some A-levels, and Leeds, in its innocence, said you can come and read Chinese. Why did I do Chinese? Very simple. Do you remember university grants? Can you throw your mind back that far? Chinese was 4 years. Most other languages were 3-4 years on a grant. I mean, you know. Also, I have to say, everybody was doing Russian. It was the height of the Cold War. Russian was very popular, and Chinese was not popular at all. So being a contrarian, I decided, obviously, you've got to do Chinese. Okay, that's what brought me to Leeds. Leeds was wonderful. The staff were fantastic. I have to say that because I've spotted 3 of them here tonight, and several students who were contemporaneous with me as well. Obviously, and I've just been looking at your Owen Latimore exhibition outside, which is fantastic. Obviously, Owen, although a diminutive man, was an intellectual colossus, and we were, I think I can say we undergraduates, were all in awe of him. He was a wonderful guy, and what I remember most about him is that he used to teach history in the first person. So, you know, with his lovely soft American accent, he would say things like, "So, I said to Chiang Kai-shek, Generalissimo, if I were you, etc." He actually did. And Owen's great interest, of course, was Mongolia rather than China. And while I was there, it was probably in about 1969 or 67, I don't recall, we opened a very mysterious room down in the basement of the Red Brick House. The Red Brick House, which was Chinese studies in those days. I'm going to break off here and press a button. No, I've done it, darling. Years as a correspondent. And Owen's great interest was Mongolia. And I remember towards just not long before he retired, these strange people would creep into the basement room, the graduate students of Mongolian studies, mainly people from the Foreign Office who'd either thought they might do something very wrong or had done something wrong and were about to be posted to the Gulag archipelago of Ulaanbaatar. So one felt rather sorry for them. I'll only tell one brief story about Owen, and it's one that sticks in my mind. He smoked Rothmans. Rothmans, in those days was compulsory, more or less, at Leeds, and the lecture theatres had a sort of haze of cigarette smokes. The lecturers would smoke, the students would smoke, and we'd all try and find the door at the end. Well, Owen smoked Rothmans, and he used cigarette smoking a little bit, I think, a bit like Harold Wilson used his pipe in interviews to kind of pause for thought and give himself time to say something. And Owen was also a very noisy smoker, which is unusual. And not long before he retired, I know there's one or two people here. Where is he? One of them, two of them, who will remember this lecture. He would teach us history once a week. And he was giving one particular lecture, which was about camels. And because he had his own camel train, which he used to take across the Gobi Desert. And it was all to do with, in fact, how much you could load onto a camel. It was the original straw that broke the camel's back sort of lecture. It was absolutely fascinating. And he would stop for a cigarette halfway through a sentence, by the way. And after a while, he would stop and he'd get it. It was like a Japanese tea ceremony. He would get out the packet of Rothmans. Light up and go and carry on. The following week, he gave exactly the same lecture. He forgot he'd given it to us, you see. And because we were so in awe of him, nobody said a word. But the amazing thing was, he paused at exactly the same point to bring out the Rothman. Anyway, there we are. I'm going to skip forward now. As the introduction said, I joined Reuters. There were about 8 of us. I was the only one not from public school in Oxbridge. Secondary modern school in Leeds didn't quite hack it, but I seem to have survived. And they were all male, well, except for one, actually, and we weren't sure about him, but more or less all male, anyway. And like every other graduate trainee in Reuters, I had to go through a sort of induction process, a probation process, they called it. A couple of them dropped by the wayside, and I managed through basically being a coward to avoid being sent to Northern Ireland, which I regard as probably my greatest achievement in my early years at Reuters. And finally, I was sent in the winter of 1974 to Peking. All right, sorry, not cold, are you?
No, I've got a mobile as well.
Okay. Would you like to tell us all about it?
I just have.
Is it an interesting call? Okay, fair enough. Carry on. That's okay, don't worry. I'm pulling your leg. I should say, by the way, that before going to China, I got married to a Leeds graduate who was the prettiest and most intelligent...
It's American calling and they just won't take no for an answer.
You just carry on, you know. She was the prettiest and most intelligent one I could find, and a Leeds graduate. So her name was Elizabeth, and still is, and we're still married. Amazing. So off we flew to Hong Kong, where we were given a light indoctrination, and then this amazing transition from the bright free world of advertising and colours and noise into Red China. And I don't know if any of you, I know some of you do remember how it was in those days. You used to catch a train from the old station in Kowloon. I don't know if I think the station's still there anymore. That train was called the G&T Express, the Gin and Tonic Express, because very clever Cantonese had realised that foreigners coming out of China probably hadn't had a gin and tonic for months, and they came round with iced gin and tonic, but you didn't get that going in. And the train stopped at the Lo Wu Bridge, I think it was called the Lo Wu Bridge, over the Shenzhen River, and you got out, and no one would cross the bridge. No porters, nobody. So you picked up your baggage, there's the Union Jack on one side, Chinese flag on the other, and across you went to the bridge, and you moved from the incredible brash, colourful, noisy emporium, that's the wrong word, which is Hong Kong, into a land of pastel colours where everyone wore green and blue, and you're welcomed with a cold omelette on the other side, and all your baggage was searched. And woe betide anyone who had a copy of Playboy, because that wasn't going into China. Then you got on another train, you were taken to the cavernous Dongfang Hotel in Canton. I'm going to use old words like Canton and Peking, because that's what we called them then, and I'm unreformed. And then another train up to Peking. Life in Peking was very strange. I was somewhat nervous on the way in, because one of my colleagues, Anthony Gray, was held for 2 years in solitary confinement, and only released a few years before I got there. There was then an interregnum when Reuters had nobody in China. And the worst thing they did to poor old Tony Gray was hang his cat. So, as a cat lover, I was a bit worried about that. But he got out and he wrote a book about it called Hostage in Peking, which I always thought was an amazing work, because what can you write about being held in one room for 2 years? But he seems to have managed it. Foreigners, by the time I was there, were not permitted to live in private residences in Hutongs or the Old City. We were all crammed into foreigners' compounds, and the gates were guarded by People's Liberation Army, PLA soldiers with fixed bayonets, and no Chinese were allowed in without a special permit. There was quite a lot of activity, as you would imagine, around social events. The Bell was the pub in the British Embassy. The British ambassador was Edward Ude, later Sir Edward Ude, who became very briefly governor of Hong Kong before dying of a massive heart attack. There was a place called the Guoju Julebu, the international club, which the Chinese had set up for foreigners, where you could play tennis and that kind of thing. And you could go to the Yoi Shangdian, the department store. There was also a friendship store. Someone remind me of the name of the friendship store. Oh, that was the Yoi Shangdian. Oh, I'm thinking of the Bai Huo Dalo. Okay, the Bai Huo Dalo in Wangfujing was where the Chinese could go, and we went to the Yoi Shangdian. The Yoi Shangdian was interesting. It was supposed to be just for foreigners, but there were always very high-ranking Chinese army officers and cadres around in rather well-cut suits buying things as well. I suspect when you come to ask questions, you're going to ask a little bit more about how we got information and how we operated in Peking. The answer, of course, was with great difficulty. But after 2 or 3 years there were wrinkles that you learned. Any kind of social intercourse with the Chinese was extremely difficult, if not impossible, regardless of whether you could speak Chinese. The normal reaction to anyone in the street when you approach them, even to ask the way, was for them to run away. If they told you the way, they would then be surrounded by people asking what they'd said. If you went into a Chinese a masses restaurant, as opposed to one where foreigners normally went, it was very embarrassing, because if the restaurant was full, a table would be cleared for you, regardless of whether the people had finished their meal, and then they wanted to get rid of you as quickly as possible. If you went into a shop where there was normally queuing, you would be ushered to the front of the queue. Again, very embarrassing. So these sort of things happened. The foreign community in Peking in that time obviously consisted of diplomats and a certain number of journalists and a certain number of so-called journalists. The so-called journalists tended to be people like TASS and the countries of the Soviet Empire, Czechoslovakia and Hungary, who had even worse access than we did, because, of course, this was the time of the Sino-Soviet split. If anyone accuses the Chinese of not having a sense of humour, they renamed the street where the Soviet embassy was Anti-Revisionist Street. So there is a little sense of humour ticking away in there somewhere. I don't think I'll say much more about that. The people. What was made China amazing for me and really exciting, apart from the obvious things, were the very esoteric and eccentric group of foreigners who one found there. Claire Hollingsworth, who's still alive, she's about 100 now, is without a doubt, I think, unarguably Britain's leading lady war correspondent. She still lives in Hong Kong, and she still shows up at the Foreign Correspondents Club from time to time, where she has her own chair. Claire was there, and she was old in 1974. I thought she was. The late David Bonnevere of the Times was an amazing character. He'd been expelled from Moscow for getting too close to the dissidents. Well, there was not much chance of him getting close to dissidents in China, because China didn't work like that. And he wrote a wonderful book about being expelled from Moscow, which again I commend to you, called Fat Sasha and the Urban Guerrilla. George Bush was head of the USLO, the US Liaison Office. The US and China did not at that time have full diplomatic relations. Remember, there was the two China policy and all that kind of thing. And so there were liaison offices, a Chinese one in Washington and a US one in Peking. And dear old George Bush, he went quite a long way, didn't he? We didn't know he was going to. He was just an ambassador in all but name. And he and Barbara would cycle around Peking on their bikes and do other things as well. One character was called John Burns. He still writes for the New York Times, but in those days, he's actually Canadian, there were no American journalists. It was wonderful in Peking because of relations, and John was working for the Toronto Globe and Mail, was always getting into trouble. One of the things we... Am I right? Am I boring you yet?
Not yet, but I'm going to tell you what to do.
Oh, thanks. One of the things we did was go frequently to the airport, where visiting heads of state were given what they called the relie huanying, the great warm welcome of dancing girls and waving flowers. And then that would be followed by a banquet at the Great Hall of the People. And I went to many, many, many of those. The press table was so far removed from the top table that had it been any further, it would have been in the corridor. And Claire had opera glasses to see what was going on. And it's good she did, because in 1977 she spotted the re-emergence of Deng Xiaoping, by the way, in one of those banquets. So, you know, wonderful visiting heads of state, great reformers and Democrats like Pol Pot, Khieu Samphan, Ing Sari. The Ceausescus, a delightful couple, came when we were there. And also Kim Il-sung, or Kim Il-nasty, as we knew of him. Now, Kim, father of the father, you know, you all know your Korean history. Kim, who had an enormous goiter on one side of his neck, was only ever filmed from one angle, and the Koreans were very, very upset if anyone tried to take a picture from another angle. And Kim would never travel by air. He always assumed that someone would try to kill him, probably with very good reason. So the normal welcome at Peking Airport was transposed to Peking Railway Station, because Kim came from Pyongyang by train, and all the dancing girls and this kind of thing. Kim arrives, is met, does his tour of China. 10 days later, the relie huansung, for those Chinese speakers, the warmly go away, was also transposed to Peking Railway Station. Well, I was there with a lady called Margaret Jones, who worked for the Melbourne Age. She was known as the Age of Peking. And she and I were taking pictures, and there was a terrific photo opportunity on the platform of Peking Railway Station with Kim Il-sung, Prince Norodom Sihanouk, who was in exile in Peking but also had a residence in Pyongyang, and Deng Xiaoping, the three of them together. It's a terrific picture. Took our pictures, thought no more of it. Until about a month later, when the then president of the Sino-British Trade Council, Lord Nelson of Keswick, was invited to go to Pyongyang, very unusually, on some kind of trade delegation. And he and his group were locked into the cinema and forced to watch 1.5 hours without a wee-wee of respected and beloved's visit to China. At the very end, the camera zooms in on me and Margaret Jones and says, "Look at these American reporters skulking brazenly in the background." Ever since then, I've tried to skulk brazenly. And Steve Fitzgerald, who some of you know, was accredited to Pyongyang, had to sit through the same film. Finally, on the sort of thing the Chinese did for us, there were facility trips. Facility trips generally followed the same pattern, and it was fairly rigid, whether you were going to Dajai, the model commune, to be lied to there, or whether you were going somewhere else to be lied to. You would be whisked away. There would be a welcome banquet from the local authorities. You would then go and you'd sit down in long tables. There'd be peanuts and tea, and you would have the sadly misnamed brief introduction. The brief introduction could easily last three times as long as my talk, and was always preceded by the words under the leadership of da-da-da-da, the intonation, and while criticizing Lin Biao and Confucius, we da-da-da, and then you'd get the lies at the end. It's terrible. And we would put up with this, even though you would go back to places where 3 years earlier someone had heard a totally different story, and you would tend not to say anything. There was one facility trip, and I honestly can't remember where it was. I think it was somewhere near Hangzhou, which was, even by the standards of facility trips, was absolutely dire. And the Yugoslavs, were one of them was the doyen of the press corps, and got up at the final banquet, heaping praise on the Chinese hosts for the wonderful trip that we'd had. And John Burns, who I mentioned earlier, was a bit drunk by that time, which was not unusual. And he suddenly stood up and said, "That's all total bollocks. It's been the worst trip we've ever had. You've lied to us from beginning to the end. Moreover, we found you out in factual errors. And frankly, I do not support what this man whose name was Dragoslav Rancic, Comrade Rancic, has said. He's nothing but a sycophantic greaseball in an electric suit." At this point, there was silence until Rancic's sidekick, who spoke better English, sort of interpreted it for him. But the sidekick, by the way, is called, unfortunately, his name is Arsic. Arsic told him what to be. Rancic was a big man, square head, looked as though it had a bolt through it, strode across the room, got hold of Burns, who was also large, and took a swing at him. Burns went back with a straight left hook. Finally, they were separated. The Chinese were incredibly embarrassed, excruciatingly embarrassed, and there were no more facility trips for 4 months. Okay. 1976. Are you still awake? Is Bilotti still all right there?
Yeah.
There you go. Okay. Just have a little chat on your phone.
Sure,
you know.
I'll look at those.
Okay. 1976. Well, I made a bad move at the beginning of 1976. I had been cultivating, grooming, you would say these days, the North Vietnamese ambassador during the latter 2 years of the war, telling him I really wanted to go to Hanoi. And shortly after the fall of Saigon, lo and behold, he said, "Okay, you can go to Hanoi." And so in very early January, in fact, I think it may even have been New Year's Day, our New Year's Day, not Chinese New Year's Day, 76, Liz and I traveled overland to Hanoi, which I'm not going to tell you about. It was an amazing trip. And we got into the state guest house in Hanoi. For those of you who speak Vietnamese, the Tang Loi Hotel, the Victory Hotel, ghastly place, enormous rats. And turned on my little BBC radio the next morning, Joe and Lai had died. He died on January 11th. I thought, bloody hell, you know. Not clever. Eventually, we got out of North Vietnam, having been arrested for filming a B-52 in a paddy field, but that's another story. I got out to Laos, where the Pathet Lao had just taken over, and finally got across the river into Thailand and got back to Peking to miss just about everything to do with the death of Zhou Enlai. The following month, I heard from a source at Peking University that there were posters had gone up in a closed area. What they would do in the university, they would have this sort of raffia screens, and these areas were areas where no foreign students were allowed to go. My source didn't know what it was about. It was still very cold. February is a cold time in Peking, as you know. So I dressed up with my white mask and my dogskin cap, my padded jacket and my old flying pigeon bicycle, and rode to the university with my camera under my coat, James Bond style, and managed to get very briefly into this area, take a few pictures. All the posters were attacking Deng Xiaoping by name. So he didn't last long after the death of Zhou. And got out. It was a good story, except I was called into the foreign ministry and given a final warning. I've had about four of those final warnings. And I remember Ma Yujun, who later became Chinese ambassador to London, dear old Mr. Ma, saying, "Mr. Griffiths, you've lifted a stone only to drop it on your own foot." But they let me stay. April, we move on from February to April, Qingming, the tomb cleaning ceremony. All the academics here know very well what Qingming is. This was the opportunity for the people, and I really mean the people. This was not something contrived, but actually a spontaneous uprising for the people to say, we loved Zhou Enlai, and by implication, we quite like Deng Xiaoping, his protege. And so for several days before Qingming, which was on April the 4th, thousands of wreaths and things like this were taken into Tiananmen Square. They started off being piled up around the martyrs' monument. There's a picture out there, you can see them. And on the 4th, you could go into the square, and it was the most amazing thing. There was real spontaneity. You know, having lived for years under sort of Orwellian 1984, everything being organized, nothing being spontaneous, this was marvelous. And they almost beat you up for not taking pictures. The crowds were that fantastic. And there were people writing poems. And of course, the classic, wonderful classic Chinese education I've received at Leeds came to the fore, because there were puns in Chinese. They wrote poems about Yao, meaning devils, but of course they meant Yao Wenyuan. It was a pun. And this allusion, literary allusions, by the way, loomed very large in our attempted reporting of Chinese affairs. Overnight, the militia came in, smashed heads, and all of those poems, posters, wall posters, wreaths were cleared away. And I went at dawn the next morning. The streets had been hosed down. There was nothing there. And that day, April the 5th, was the first Tiananmen incident. I know we all think of a later event, but it was the first Tiananmen incident, because on the 5th, the crowds built up and built up and built up. They were very angry. It was a slightly nervous place to be. You tried to keep a low profile. By the end of the afternoon, the pine trees around Tiananmen Square were on fire. The smell of wood burning and crackling. There were two or three vehicles on fire, petrol tanks going whoomph. I went down with dear old Claire Hollingsworth on my arm. She had cataracts. She couldn't see terribly well. And every time there was a whoomph, she got terribly excited. Ooh, what was that? Another petrol tank's gone up, Claire. And there was a PSB, a public security building, in the corner of the square, which was ablaze. And rather bizarrely, while the building was burning, the ground floor of the building was ablaze, there were still people on the top throwing out documents. This went on for several hours. The authorities held back. Troops did not come in. And suddenly, about 8 o'clock in the evening, I was with this tape recorder, actually, trying to record the mayor of Peking, who I think his name is Wu De. He suddenly announced, the loudspeakers crackled into life and said, everyone must clear the square, there are bad people here. And I was recording this voice when I was grabbed by people. Not an unusual event for me in China. And I was sort of frog marched into the Forbidden City, right through the main door of the Forbidden City. And inside, a military camp had been set up. I mean, there were thousands of soldiers just waiting orders. I was taken into a room, and they tried to interrogate me. And if ever this happens to you, you do not speak Chinese, because then they've got to go and find someone who speaks English. It gives you time to think. Never be interrogated in a foreign language, no matter how well you speak it. Anyway, they listened to my tape, and I said, how can this be bad? It is the mayor of Peking, Wu De. He is a very important man. And then they turned the tape over, and on it was a message to my mother. We used to send tapes backwards and forwards, all about flowers in the garden, and they were terribly interested. And what is all this about azaleas? Is this some kind of foreign code? Anyway, they let me go. That was Qingming. Deng, by the way, was not rehabilitated until 1977, the year afterwards. That year, that amazing year of 1976. Hello, Mr. Whittaker. I'm glad you could make it. Rome is a long way, isn't it? I'll carry on. That amazing year of 1976 continued with the Tangshan earthquake. That was in July. Mercifully, it was in the summer, because even in Peking, which was 90 miles from Tangshan, the entire population moved out into the streets and lived in makeshift tents and shelters, because there was about a fortnight of aftershocks, and some of the aftershocks were very big. I was sort of knocked out of bed at 4 a.m. My dear wife was away attending her father's funeral in Yorkshire. I was knocked out of bed, but my cat had warned me first that something was up, and we were in very modern, really, modern foreigners' blocks, which were not earthquake-proof, but earthquake-resistant. So I don't think we were any in Peking in any great physical danger, although I'm told that 700 people did die in Peking, mainly in the Yellow City, in the Hutongs and the Old City, which in those days, and to a certain extent still today, surrounds the Forbidden City. That was 8.2 on the Richter scale. The Chinese said it was 6.8 because there was some trigger, UN trigger, where if an earthquake reaches a certain level on the Richter scale, there is automatically foreign aid. They didn't want any foreign aid. About 500,000 dead. Pretty hairy thing. Gough Whitlam, the former Australian Labor Prime Minister and his wife, was visiting Tientsin at the time. Tangshan was 90 miles from Peking, but only 70 miles from Tientsin. Tientsin was really quite badly hit. I don't know how many people were killed there, but his hotel sort of split in half, and in his pajamas, he and his wife had to run downstairs, and I think a wardrobe had crashed across the bed, and she had been cut, not terribly badly, but she had blood down her from this wardrobe falling down. The Chinese laid on a military flight to fly them both to Peking and fairly early in the morning. And Steve Fitzgerald, lovely guy who I played poker with, said, "I'm going to meet Gough Whitlam. Do you want to come with me?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, Steve, I'd like to." So we jumped into the Australian car, flag flying, went out to the airport, and I did a little interview with Gough Whitlam. By this time, they had Chinese army greatcoats on when they came down. And this is something of an aside, a disabling dichotomy, as one of my professors here was fond of saying. Years later, and quite a few years later, I was in East Timor, and I met Gough Whitlam, who I like very much, by the way, and we were chatting away, and I reminded him of this. He said to me, "You bastard." I said, "I'm terribly sorry, Gough. What have I done?" He said, "Ah, you're the cause of all my problems." And apparently, when he went back, his political enemies, and I don't know whether it was the Sydney Morning Herald or the Melbourne Age, I don't know which one is left-wing, which one is right-wing, but they had a cartoon of Gough Whitlam and his wife coming down the steps of the aircraft based on the picture I'd taken. And the caption said, "Did the earth move for you too, darling?" Anyway, he was only joking. He didn't mind at all. I'm assuming most of you are Chinese scholars, and most of you know that in Chinese mythology, an earthquake is a portent of doom, a portent of the change of a dynasty. So the Tangshan earthquake, if you like, had more importance than the fact that it was hugely destructive and many, many people died. Because it was followed very soon after by the death of Mao on September the 9th. I knew something was up, and we had an old... You're still alive, still awake? You're going to get to ask questions in a minute. Okay. I had an old telex machine, Shanghai telex machine, which vibrated so much that when you fed the tape into it, it actually moved across the floor like that. And you would punch a tape on a tape machine, and then you'd feed the tape in. It's very expensive. This is the days when communications were tough, you know. And I was told there was going to be a portentous announcement. And there had been clashes on the Azuri River. Relations with the Soviet Union were at a nadir. And I honestly didn't know whether it was Mao dead or war with the Soviet Union. So I prepared two tapes. One, China declares war on the Soviet Union. And the other one, Mao dead official. Fortunately, I did not mix them up. Because the radio started, and it doesn't tell you what's happening straight away. You get all the music, and you know, eventually they say Mao's dead, but didn't say quite like that. And fortunately, I put the right tape into the Shanghai telex. Otherwise, he might not be here today. And then, very, very finally, on October the 6th, Gang of Four arrested, and I've got one small claim to fame. It's a very, very small claim to fame. In Chinese, Gang of Four was Sulanban, okay? And the Xinhua News Agency and its English service and Shankal Shaoshi, probably mispronounced that, Reference News, which we weren't supposed to see but we did, which was a compilation of foreign press reports with some other things, rendered it as the four-person clique. So for several days, Gang of Four was the four-person clique. I thought, bloody hell, that's an awful translation. Let's call them the Gang of Four. So Reuters started saying the Gang of Four, and the Chinese followed suit. That's it. Now, I suggest, for those of you still awake, there's a lady there not smiling at all. A bit worried about her. No, she's still not smiling. Do you want to make comments, statements, throw things, or ask questions? Silence. Can I go home? Bill Oddie is still awake. Yes, ma'am.
Can I ask a question that goes to the contemporary, in the sense that I was in China from 1984 to 86, and when I was in China at that time, the slogan was Wei Ren and Fool, yeah, to serve the people, yes? My impression, and I haven't been back since, because of the Tiananmen massacre, I haven't been back, I get the impression now that the ethos is Wei Zizi Fu. Yeah? And I wonder what
thoughts are of that. Yeah, I don't think I have anything terribly profound to say. We talk about the ruling Communist Party in China. Of course, we don't mean that, do we? We mean the ruling party. That's all I would say, really. One of the things about being in China is the longer you're there, and I was there for 3.5 years, the less you realize you know about it. Visiting sort of firemen, particularly female American academics, kind of dropped in from time to time while I was there. And after 3 weeks, they'd write a book. And then someone would come along and stay 6 months and think, well, I don't really think I can write a book. And then you stay 3 years and realize you can't write a book. I think the more you know about China, certainly in those days, the less you knew about China. Does that help you? It probably doesn't, actually.
It was very frustrating.
It was very frustrating indeed. Bonnevere often would contrast it to his time in Moscow, from where he was expelled, because he did have a relationship with Soviet dissidents. There were plenty of people you could talk to in the Soviet Union. In China, it was very, very difficult. We did have sources, particularly after 3.5 years. And I don't just mean diplomatic sources, I don't just mean students, foreign students living in China. We did have one or two sources, but probably not going to talk about them even now. But yes, we did. But you could not just go up to people in the street and talk to them. Didn't happen like that.
Could
very
you
difficult.
Could you live in Hong Kong and talk to people in Hong Kong that have come to China?
Of course you could, yeah. But in Peking in those days, it was very difficult. We were quite tightly constrained. Apart from living in compounds guarded by troops, apart from the populace in general having been told not to talk to us, even where we could move was constrained. As you drove out of Peking, and there would come a certain point where there'd be a big sign, no foreigners beyond this point, in Russian, Chinese, probably French as well. There were corridors you were allowed to drive along to the Ming tombs, where you could go out and get drunk and have a picnic, and the Great Wall. At one point, my predecessor was able to drive on his own, amazingly, and they certainly soon clamped down on that, to Tientsin. He spoke very good Chinese. He's a graduate of this university, Jonathan Sharp. And some of you will remember him. And Jonathan's Chinese, I think, much better than mine. And they opened up a corridor. They said, OK, as long as you stick to the road, you can drive to Tientsin, without his driver, which is quite unusual. And he tells me he got to a fork in the road, halfway between Peking and Tientsin, and it really wasn't clear what way to go. And there were a couple of peasants in the field. So Jonathan gets out of the car and walks towards them and said very clearly, "Excuse me, can you tell me which way to go to Tianjin?" Silence. So he rephrased it and said, "Excuse me, if I turn left, will I get to Tianjin?" Complete silence. And then he rephrased it another way, and their mouths were hanging open. And as he was walking away, he said, one peasant turned to the other and said, "I could have sworn that foreigner was asking the way to Tianjin." You're being very reticent.
So, you've told us a lot about the political side of things. What about the social life in Peking at that time? Was there any?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was almost nothing but. I mean, there was the usual round of cocktail parties, banquets and adultery that you find in all these places. And lots and lots of social life. Well, for example, David Bonnivier, my great friend, my late friend, who sadly drank himself to death, but was a wonderful writer. He read Chinese at Cambridge, which is a much lesser university than this one. But despite having read Chinese at Cambridge, his Chinese was brilliant. David was a wonderful linguist. He spoke fantastic Russian. He spoke and read wonderful Chinese and taught himself Finnish for fun. He was that sort of person. And David, who enjoyed a drink or three, would have a game in the evening, one of the social games. It's called the Wei game. And you know that Chinese, when they speak on the phone, they say, "Wei, Wei." Funny, a lot of countries' languages have special words for hello on the phone, don't they? I mean, the Italians say pronto, the Japanese say mashi mashi. You know, but the Chinese say Wei. So the Wei game is very simple. The phone book in Peking was a state secret. And anyway, no individuals had phones, only Danways, only units had phones, and foreigners. So what we would do, after a sufficient amount of alcoholic lubrication, you'd have a stopwatch, you see, for this game, you stopwatch. You pick up the phone, dial a Peking number at random, and someone at the other end says, "Wei," and you go, "Wei." And you could see how long you could keep that going for, "Wei, Wei, Wei, Wei," you see. After about 15 seconds, when you sense the guy was about to hang up, you'd say, "Hey, Lao Li Zimer, is old Lee there?" Now, there's always an old Lee. And the guy would say, "Shama Lao Li." "Which old Lee?" "Oh, Ni Zhao Lao Li Ya, Wei." And anyway, that was it. That was the Wei game. It was very simple. So that was a social event, wasn't it? And the other game which David Bonnivier, I love David Bonnivier, he's a wonderful guy, that he would play was a Desmond. Does anyone know what a Desmond is?
Tutu.
Exactly, a tutu, yes. Yes, as I'm constantly reminded. It was very frustrating because, as I said earlier, unofficial, free-ranging conversations with ordinary Chinese people were very difficult, if not impossible. In 3.5 years, I suppose I had a dozen conversations of that nature. So it was extremely frustrating. What was useful was being able to read Chinese, because wall posters went up. Wall posters were often ripped down by the authorities almost as soon as they went up. So when you heard some wall posters had gone up, you jumped on your bike and off you scuttled. And of course, these were in cursive script, in grass writing, incredibly hard to read. So I would take my friend David Bonnivier, whose Chinese was wonderful, and I'd still be struggling with the first line of the wall poster, and he'd be tugging on my sleeve saying, I've read it, let's go. Fantastic. More often or not, I'd try and photograph them, and then we'd get back, and the bathroom would be a dark room, quickly process the negatives, shine them on the wall, and then we had time to sit down and read them. But I was arrested countless times and had film ripped from my camera countless times, and sometimes they even got the film with the pictures on, but not often.
Peter, did you spend a year in China as part of your degree?
Sorry, can you say that again?
Did you spend a year in China as part of your degree?
No, absolutely not. That's a good question. No, sadly, when I took my degree, there were no student exchanges to China. We were warned not to go to Taiwan because the Chinese would find out, and therefore we would never get to China. So I had a sort of plan when I came to Leeds, cunning plan, that I'd work really, really hard in the first year and not get chucked out, have a wonderful time in the next two years and do some travelling, and work hard enough in the last year to get a degree at Desmond. And I think the first student exchanges started while I was in Peking, and I think probably in about 1975 or maybe 76. And we entertained students from Leeds. One of them, Angela Newsom, is on her way from France at the moment, and she says she's arriving tomorrow, which is why I'm recording this for her. She's insisting I do it. Some went to Fudan in Shanghai, some went to Beidar, I think some went to Nanking, and she was very unlucky. She went to Manchuria, Shenyang. Fate worse than death. But no, it was very sad. Second summer at Leeds, I went to Israel just after the Six-Day War. That was quite interesting. And my third year, I went to Iran and Afghanistan. But not China. Not China. Very sad. Yeah. Maybe that's why my Chinese is no good. Mr. Jenner, the man with the eyebrows. My God. Now, this is a wonderful guy. He looks terribly young. But he was always young. Eternally young. What is that? Is it some kind of drug? And when I saw him, I only recognised the eyebrows. Bill.
Have you had any dealings after an interval of time with any of your minders?
Yes.
And have you been able to have franker conversations with them?
Yes.
Could you tell us anything?
I spent some years in Geneva working out of the Palais des Nations, which is the European headquarters of the UN, and quite a few Chinese came through, and one or two sought me out. I did have some dealings with Ma Yujun, who became ambassador here. I even had dealings with Chi Minzong. I don't know if anyone remembers Chi Minzong. He was known as Cat Strangler Chi, because he was the official responsible for killing Anthony Gray's cat. Chi Minzong was particularly interesting. I think he may be dead now, so I think I can say this. But in a urinal of a restaurant off Fleet Street, we were standing in, I'd invited a Xinhua delegation to Reuters, and we were in adjacent stalls. You have these conversations. And he said, "I want you to know, Mr. Griffiths, that if it wasn't for me, Mr. Gray would have had a far worse time." And I had one or two other conversations with one or two Chinese officials and ex-officials, who I'm still in touch with. One of the conversations was quite interesting. I won't say with whom it was, about the left-wing sort of Maoist fellow travelers, workers, English students who they used to get out in China in my day and slightly afterwards. And I mean, some of these students, apparently, not all students, but workers, translators, would be more Maoist than the Chinese and wave their red books with even more fervor and spout the semi-religious sayings with even more fervor than the Chinese. And this guy said to me, he said, "Peter, you know, we had to do it to survive. They seem to believe it." Sir, Mr. Green.
Peter.
The follicularly challenged one.
Not so much a question, but a comment.
I was afraid of that.
For those of you who don't know, you really want to hear me do, the last time Peter and I met was in Guangzhou in about 75, I think.
You had hair then?
And I elder my ex-wife. Sorry.
Have a Rothmans. Stop.
I gave up, you know. Sorry, I'm a bit emotionally challenged tonight, but listening to Peter, who I remember well, and he hasn't changed over how many years? Peter and I last met with Elder in Guangzhou. In 75, where we were working. Peter came later to Beijing. We were elderly. were working in Guangzhou, and I must say I have a different memory. Sorry, it's good. Can we pass on? I'll talk in later.
Are you okay?
Sorry, no, I'm fine.
You like some water?
I'm just...
I'm not at all surprised that David is a little emotional. Even I, and I'm not a very emotional person, do get emotional about some of the things that I've spoken about, particularly about the fate of one Cambodian boy, which is a bit self-indulgent when about a third of the population of Cambodia was killed by the Khmer Rouge to be worrying about one person, but he was the one I knew. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to ask you about some of the... You talked about the other foreign correspondents and people who were there, but I wondered, I thought it perhaps might be interesting also for our students to hear about the some of the rather interesting characters who had made... Westerners who'd made their homes in China because they believed in the Chinese Revolution and so on.
Yeah. Well, some of them were rather sad, yes.
Did you sort of have contact with?
Quite a few of them. But we were regarded as the Yingord Zolgol, the English running, the British running dogs. Mm. We were the Digord Yuizhe. And I think we were... we had better relations with the Chinese than we did with some of the fellow travellers. But we did know them. There were one or two very old residents of Shanghai from before 1949. Who was still there, long dead, and they were very, very interesting, and they still lived in those days in Shanghai, Brits.
And they were quite interesting. What had they done in the old days?
Oh, well, they'd just taken up residence in Shanghai under the nationalists in, 1944, 45, 46, survived the Japanese, and they were still there. One lady in particular was absolutely wonderful. I can talk about them now because they're all dead, but they had all kinds of interesting information about what was going on in Shanghai. Mm-hmm. There were other sources we had around, maybe some of them less obvious than others. Getting information was always fun. Are you... Do you want me to go on?
Yes.
You sure? You're totally polite, aren't you? All right. We were only allowed to read the Renminbi Bao, the People's Daily, and the so-called... a cultural daily, the Guangming about, both ghastly. We were not supposed to read the Peking daily, the Beijing about. We were certainly not supposed to read the Jiefang Junbao, the military newspaper. But we discovered in Wangfujing, which in those days was a little tiny lane with small state-run shops and a market in the street, there was a certain vegetable seller who always wrapped the cabbages in the Jiefang Junbao. So we would... send the driver down to buy cabbages, and we'd say, no, you must go to this particular... And then you'd scrape the vegetable off it, and you could read it. And there were all kinds... I mean, looking, you had to read between the lines when you read the Guangming and the People's Daily, because there were all kinds of literary allusions. And it was useful at Leeds to have studied Hung Lo Mung and the water margin, because they were political campaigns with allegories of those things. So if you had a little bit of a classical background, you could get somewhere, and puns like, Pi Lin Pi Kung criticise Lin Biao. You all know who Lin Biao was, the defence minister who topped himself in a British aircraft allegedly fleeing to Russia, a British-made aircraft, a Chinese aircraft, but made by us. And Confucius. Why should they link together Lin Biao and Confucius? Big campaign, Pi Lin Pi Kung, criticise Lin Biao, criticise Confucius. Well, it seems, you're all historians, or some of you are, I'm not, that one of Confucius's favourite people was the Duke of Zhou, Zhou Enlai. So they were criticising Zhou Enlai by criticising Confucius, or so it seemed. Maybe not. Who knows? Yes, ma'am.
Are there like any social sort of habits
I don't think so, because it's so easy to speak to people in China now. I mean, I've been back a few times recently, and wherever I'm in China, people are kind of getting hold of you, and you think, oh God, he wants to sell me something. No, he wants to practice English. Wherever you go, it's marvellous, you know, sort of, you know, Yunnan or Xi'an or wherever it is, some bloke, and so you have to make a deal with them. Say, look, we'll do 10 minutes Chinese, 10 minutes English. So speaking to the Chinese now is wonderful. I mean, you can speak to anyone. It's totally different. So there's no techniques I could have learned then which would be of any help now. Just go and talk to the Chinese, you know. It's wonderful. Not very helpful. Yes, ma'am.
Can I ask, what was it like then for your wife going in with you at that time?
What was it like for my wife?
Yes, what was her life like? Is your...
It's still awful. Poor girl. I mean, you know. No, it was very tough because she was an economist and, you know, was actually doing a PhD here when I plucked her away and took her to China. So that put paid to that. She started up a little informal school teaching English to third world diplomats and their wives. She learned a lot of Chinese in 3.5 years. She couldn't read, but she could, and write, but she could speak pretty well. And she came with me on some of my adventures. She came to North Vietnam and things like that. I mean, but it's very interesting, actually. I was never any good at tones. And dear Liz was traveling on her own one day across China by train, and the foreigners were forced to go first class. They didn't have to push too hard to make us go there, by the way. And she was in a compartment on her own, foreign lady, and the train man came and said, would you like something to eat? And she wanted to say, I'd like some soup. But sadly, what she said was, I'd like some sugar. And obviously the Chinese think, well, foreigners are very, very odd, aren't they? And the guy showed up with a bowl of sugar, which just goes to show how important your tones are. Yes, ma'am. In China, and not as widely as I'd like to. I didn't get to go to Tibet, which I'd love to have done. I didn't get to Sichuan. We went to Manchuria, Shenyang, you know, the northeast, Shenyang, and that, we went to the normal places like Hangzhou. Did I go to Xi'an? I think I probably did. Not as many Wuhan, not as many places as I'd like to. Oh, we went to Xinjiang. There was a wonderful facility trip which really did work, to Xinjiang. And that was good. That was good fun. We spent about 2 weeks in Xinjiang. But in those days, the only way you could travel was as part of an official foreign ministry organized group. There was no individual travel at all. So if they wanted you to go there, you would go. Interminable trips to Yangtze River bridges, you know. There was a road bridge and a rail bridge. And they'd give you the brief introduction, and an hour and a half later, they'd say, this is a three-use bridge. Hang on a minute, it's a road bridge and a rail bridge. Surely it's a two-use bridge. No, 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 it goes over a river. Well, hang on a minute, if it didn't go over anything, it wouldn't be a bridge. We had these conversations.
Can I just make a comment? I graduated in 1970. And I wasn't fortunate enough or good enough to get a job using Chinese at all for many years. But the only way I could get to China then was to join the Society for Anglo-Chinese Understanding, if you remember that. And these are, I suppose, the fellow travels that you were talking about.
I'm sure some of them must have been quite sane.
Well, I hope I was. I finally went in 75 on a Saku 17-day tour. Totally guarded all the time. Went to Beijing and saw what I could of China at a very, very early stage.
And I'm sure that the communist officials regarded us, as Lenin said, as useful idiots. But nevertheless, I got to China and I saw something of it, not to your extent, but
good.
As early as I could. You know, so that was very useful. I mean, what was your view of organisations like the Friendship Organisation?
I don't think I really had had a view of it. I mean, I was aware of it. Mm. I didn't have a meaningful view of it at all. But your wanting to get into China reminds me a little bit of my several times failed attempts to get into North Korea. And I haven't been to North Korea. A British table tennis team was going there, I think it's about 1977, and I was still in Peking, and so I decided I was actually a table tennis expert and tried to get accredited as the British table tennis correspondent. That didn't work. I've tried various other ploys to get into North Korea. I can't be bothered anymore. But a very good friend of mine who was a very, very senior man in the SIS, who's recently retired, just sent me a message saying that he'd come back from North Korea. I don't know what he was doing there. And he said, "Do you know, Griffo, it was just like China in our day." So, there you go.
Lurking and very hyper-violent.
Was I lurking brazenly?
It's a miracle you weren't picked up earlier on here. My question is, you and I were there at a very, very interesting moment in and one which, you know, as always with this being kind of capital of physical overtones now, you know, one knows what the future is going to be, if the past is deemed quite dangerous. But I wonder now, if you see Chinese officials, do you find any curiosity that they have in what you saw then? Do you find it easy to open, are they open to talk about it and so on? Or is it still subject to a sort of closed book because it's a period that's seen as being too sensitive?
I think it depends who the officials are. I mean, as I said earlier, I'm lucky enough to have one or two Chinese chums, who were, in one case, still are officials, and they, privately, yes, they will talk about that. One thing that disturbs me very slightly is when I travel in China, which I've done two or three times in the last 3 or 4 years, is that younger people either don't care or they seem woefully ignorant. You know how polite the Chinese are. If you speak a few words of Chinese, they'll say, "My God, your Chinese is wonderful." If you speak quite a bit, they'll say, "You speak a bit of Chinese." And if you're really, really fluent, they'll say, "Oh, you have one or two words of Chinese." Although I'm in the former category. They say, "Your Chinese is wonderful," because I have one or two words. And then they say, "Where did you learn?" And you say, "Well, I lived in China in these years in the Cultural Revolution when Mao was still alive," and they sort of glaze over. I don't know what it is. They don't seem to be interested in that kind of history. I don't know if this is your experience.
Mm. No, very, very similar. I mean, either it's they're not interested, or it's just not seen at the moment.
Yeah, so maybe that's it. Yeah. Yeah, that may be it. I find it quite disturbing that very few go on to ask questions. You know, no one says, "Well, what was it like?" No one does. Of the younger generation. I mean, strange. They're all too busy playing with their iPhones. Like that man there.
Well, my son's never asked me what it was like in the 60s.
That's because if you were in the 60s, you don't remember. Merciful amnesia. It's one of the great things about being old, amnesia. It's one of the two great curses, is amnesia. What's the other curse, Anthea? Not what you're thinking of, nasal hair. Yes, young man here.
Hi, I'm from China, but maybe I'm unlike the Chinese people you mentioned. I'm quite interested in Chinese politics.
Good.
Stuff like Tiananmen Square protest and the Cultural Revolution. And I've read a lot on those topics. So you mentioned Jen Wang, right?
I mentioned
Jen Wang. The, she's a Canadian correspondent in Beijing. Yeah. And
I didn't mention her. But anyway, never mind. I'm keen to hear about her.
So, have you read Red China Blues?
No.
Okay.
What is it?
Yeah, actually, it's quite a good book because Jen Wang studied Chinese during the Cultural Revolution. And the book is quite interesting, which has several chapters. The first chapter is Fool's Paradise, the second chapter is Paradise Lost, the third chapter is Paradise Regained. Because she was modest at first, and her dream was disillusioned little by little during her time in China. Also, she witnessed the Tiananmen Square protest, so the book is quite interesting.
And the book is called again?
Red China Blues.
Red China Blues. I must get hold of that. Red China Blues. Sounds good.
And also, have you read the...
There's an awful lot of things I've not read. I did have a book once, but I lost it.
Have you read the Journals of China Mao's Physician?
Ah, yes, I have. Yes.
Yes, so it's quite strange because the author was dead immediately after the book.
I read a long time ago.
He was dead in term in the U.S. at home, so I thought he was assassinated.
Who knows? Who knows? Maybe they just used sarcasm on her because, you know, that's a terrible thing. People just can just get over it. I don't know, but it's possible.
Yeah, also, I don't know what other Chinese young people think of. For me, I'm really interested. So, and I like to read the articles about China in foreign media, like The Economist. So, to know China from a Western perspective.
Let me ask you a question. You're obviously very widely read in modern Chinese literature. Do you think there are any modern, contemporary Chinese authors who are depicting this period we're talking about the way it actually was?
You mean now?
Yes, at the moment. Are people able to write about?
I'm afraid not.
That period.
At least in mainland China, or maybe in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, and then in some books published there are worth reading. But books published in China are always politically correct.